welcome to another episode of the Irish People Podcast. In this episode, we talk to Dr. Peter Cole about Ben Fletcher and his book, The Life and Times of a Black Wobbly. The book tells the story of one of the greatest heroes of the American working class. Fletcher was a brilliant union organiser and a humorous orator, and he was a tremendously important and well-loved African-American member of the IWW during its heyday. Fletcher helped found and lead Local 8 of the IWW's Marine Transport Workers Industrial Union, unquestionably the most powerful interracial union of its era, taking a principled stand against all forms of xenophobia and exclusion. Welcome, Peter. Thank you for joining us. Could we start with a short introduction about Ben Fletcher, his background, where he grew up, and his family?
Of course. Thank you again, Kiva, and for the Irish People Podcast for inviting me to sort of participate. So Ben Fletcher is not known in the United States either. So if this is an Irish audience listening, you know, people in the USA have no idea who Ben Fletcher is either. That's unfortunate, but it is sort of the truth. Why should we know about Ben Fletcher? Well, he was an African-American born and raised in the city of Philadelphia in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And shortly before World War I began, along with others on the Philadelphia waterfront, he helped to form a union of dock workers or dockers. In the US, traditionally, they use the term longshoremen, in one of the most important cities and one of the busiest ports in the country. And that union was multiracial and multi-ethnic, and also sort of belonged to the Industrial Workers of the World, or IWW. And that union basically represented the thousands of men who worked on the waterfront for almost a decade, and was probably the most racially integrated, most sort of anti-racist union of its generation, or perhaps even up until that time in US history. So why should we care about Ben Fletcher is because what we have is a sort of a black man who led a multiracial union, actually originally a white majority union, that also was unapologetically anti-capitalist and revolutionary in one of the biggest cities and ports in the country, and did what no other union in that generation did in the United States. Ben Fletcher, therefore, was one of the most important Black labor leaders in the United States in his era, or even up until that time, or even perhaps across the 20th century. And so even today, literally just a few days ago in the United States, there's been big news because a group of workers who work for Amazon in a warehouse in New York City voted to unionize, and led by a Black man and also a multiracial, multiethnic union. And that's the biggest labor story in the United States, and some people have been claiming, in 50 years, right? Ben Fletcher did this 10 years ago, right? It was a very different time and place, right? Why Fletcher is important is because he was a leader of a revolutionary union that actually effectively represented the workers in that industry, who got raises, but also did things like integrate the gangs of workers, made a safer, less abusive workplace, while simultaneously advocated for the end of the economic system of capitalism, right? Because the Industrial Workers of the World was revolutionary in its intention, founded not just to sort of help workers in the short term, but actually make a new world in the longer term.
He joined the IWW around 1910 or 11, and he also joined the Socialist Party. Could we talk a bit about how he came to join? The IWW were unique in that they organised immigrants, blacks, women, unskilled workers, hobos, which made it a different type of organisation. The Local 8, for example, were made up of one third black workers, one third Irish, and one third other European immigrants. Can we maybe talk about the importance of this? And I believe he was also quite a brilliant public speaker.
So I don't know, all good socialists, quote unquote, should be anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-homophobic, et cetera, because allegedly we're all working people and therefore we share a common enemy, employers, right? In reality, that's almost never been the case, right? Even good leftists haven't been very good when it comes to organizing women, immigrants, workers of color, et cetera. It varies, right? So the IWW didn't create the ideas of why a sort of a socialist union should be inclusive. But in the United States, there was no other union that was doing what the IWW was doing. And very quickly, the IWW was brought to or exported to a number of other countries. Their name, Industrial Workers of the World, is important for us to understand. They saw capitalism as a global problem, and therefore the solution was a global revolutionary union, not unionism inside one country. It is also important to keep in mind, although I'll talk more, this is before the Soviet Union exists. This is before the Communist Party exists, right? Those are products of the World War I and post-World War I era, just a little later. But prior to World War I, unions like the IWW, which sometimes are called syndicalist in English, sometimes called anarcho-syndicalist. I appreciate these terms are somewhat abstract, right? Was I would call it a tradition on the left that is in contrast to what was the largest socialist tradition, social democracy, as it was called, or democratic socialism, right? Which was actually the dominant trend on the left, right, in the late 1800s and early 1900s in many countries, right? This notion that you would elect people into a political power, right? And then reform could happen and ultimately revolution happen through once you elect enough people, right? There was also then anarchists and others sort of who were much more suspicious of state power, right? And the IWW, I wouldn't call it anarchist per se, but I would say that they were highly suspicious of centralism and statism, right? Later, of course, Communist Party, in particular in the Soviet Union, very much was a statist party strategy. And so even though we have anti-capitalists or people who I would call socialists with a lowercase s, the IWW was part of a tradition which was very large at that time and existed in many countries, right, including in Ireland and the UK, right, but also on the continent, as well as in Latin America, right, and North America, right. And the IWW was a part of that. Why was Ben Fletcher attracted to that? Sadly, what we know, which is to say, what I know about Fletcher is, limited somewhat. He didn't have extensive diaries or correspondence that have been left behind, sadly. But African Americans had no reason to believe that state parties, statism, or parties would be very useful because African Americans had been entirely removed from essentially the political class in the United States due to pervasive racism, right? And so for Ben Fletcher, born and raised in Philadelphia, not in the South, but nevertheless, his parents were born in the South. They were probably born enslaved before they moved to Philadelphia. Fletcher, like almost all African Americans, had no reason to buy into either the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, right? Let alone sort of a small socialist party, although Fletcher did join the Socialist Party for a while in the United States. I should also note that about one third of the dock workers in Philadelphia in 1913, when the union he helped form was born, was African American. But another third or more were probably European immigrants, right? Most immigrants actually weren't citizens of the United States, so therefore had no reason to sort of want to join parties because parties had no they had no electoral weight, right? And a lot of European immigrants, imagine going home, right, to after maybe making some money in the States. And so there was a lot of European immigrants who simply weren't citizens in the US, right? And so arguably the great majority of dock workers in Philadelphia had no reason to sort of think a political approach would be useful at all, right? An example of how African Americans often sort of had much in common with European immigrants, many of whom came from Ireland, Philadelphia being a long sort of destination for Irish immigrants. It also had many Irish American members, right? But at that time, a lot of immigrants to Philadelphia came from Eastern Europe, including places like Poland, even though that was there was no Poland officially at that time. There was Poles, right? But they were part of the Russian Empire, or maybe the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the German Empire, right? Pick an empire, right? Like, but the Poles were a part of really three empires, right? At that curious moment, you know, in the early 1900s, before the League of Nations was born and Poland was born. Before, obviously, Ireland existed either as an independent country. And so I think for Fletcher and many others, a workplace approach to radical change was quite logical. The Wobblies, one of the contributions of the Wobblies is not only that unions can help people earn more money, right, is that actually much more radical and bigger changes might occur through workplace power, right? And so that was often sort of seen as sort of suspicion of the state, but also that's the sort of syndicalist side where you see, where do people have power? They have power on the job, right? Collectively, individually we're weak, collectively we can be strong, right? And in particular, because the only essentially things that bosses respect is when their profits are impacted, forgetting about regulations on workplace hours or conditions, right? And the Wobblies believe that, right? And so therefore they didn't even sign contracts, right? All agreements were oral agreements, right? And sort of essentially on an ear basis. Why did they not want to sign contracts? Because in the United States, most labor union contracts have a no strike clause that for the duration of the contract, you can't go on strike. But the Wobblies and many other workers believed that the single greatest power that workers have is to stop work, right? One Wobbly leader, Big Bill Haywood, said, the greatest power that we have is to put our hands in our pockets, right? When we stop work, the employers listen, right? It is therefore not surprising that Ben Fletcher and other leaders in the IWW in Philadelphia struck for union recognition in May of 1913. They also were demanding raises among other changes, right? So that essentially they were born during a strike. They won that strike after several weeks of shutting down the Port of Philadelphia. They came out of that strike with raises, but also sort of a union, right, of 4,000 to 5,000 workers, pretty much all those who worked in the trade. And immediately, without asking anybody, without asking the state to change any laws, they integrated their workplaces, right? And so what had been a racially and ethnically segregated workplace, right, was integrated, I say, from below as opposed to from above, i.e. from employers or the state. So in a society and a city where workers were generally divided based on ethnicity and race, Local H just said, we're now going to work in groups that are multi-ethnic and multiracial, right? Prior to that, there would have been, say, an Irish gang, a Polish gang, a Black gang, maybe even working the same ships, but separately, right? Those sorts of divisions have been used historically and in the present by employers in many countries, but the history of the US is a history of divide and conquer, right? Workers are often weak because employers use racism, xenophobia, and other sorts of prejudices against workers, right? And because many workers share these prejudices, right? Fletcher, therefore, was attracted to the IWW, a Black man in a white supremacist country, because the IWW actually practiced what it preached, unlike many leftists that preached but rarely practiced. A form of anti-racism that was visible, right? And so for those Blacks who were not already radicals, they could just see with their own eyes as they experienced how it works in process, that who did this? It was the workers themselves who basically imposed integration, right? Which would have been a radical act, even though now that may not seem so radical. In a society and world where racism and xenophobia were pervasive, what Fletcher and others in the IWW in Philadelphia waterfront was doing was can be understood, I believe, as revolutionary, right? On some scale, right? Like, even though they were unable to achieve their more grand visions,
It was a time of major violence where the labor movement and strikes were brutally oppressed, and members of the Wobblies were even lynched, and Frank Little being one. Not to mention, it was an incredibly dangerous time for Black people in general. Can you maybe give a bit of context about the time?
So, like, the IWW in the United States, and I think in other countries too, although I know the history of the IWW in the US better, did seem to attract a lot of colorful figures. And I would use the term true believers, right? Like, and they were very much seen as such and often respected by those who might not share their politics, but could appreciate, here we have a union of hundreds of thousands in the United States, depending on the time, who were so committed. They do see themselves as revolutionary. Their sort of method was unionism, right? That often is sort of hard to understand in a world where, especially after the birth of the Soviet Union, it was seen as a political party approach was the best way to achieve, right? But, you know, when the IWW was founded in Chicago, where I live half my life, in 1905, it was founded by people including Mother Jones, of course, the Irish immigrant to the United States, who came in the 1830s, or was born in the 1830s, but moved to the States. And then as a middle-aged woman, became a union organizer and a socialist, and especially was well known for organizing children workers and minors and minors' wives, right? In Chicago was Lucy Parsons, the widow of Albert Parsons, a white anarchist from Texas originally, who had been executed by the state of Illinois in 1887 as part of the legendary Haymarket massacre and moment, right? But Lucy, who was Black, lived for many decades after the killing of her husband, right? And was an anarchist and a co-founder of the IWW in 1905, right? Eugene Debs, right? The leader of the Socialist Party, who originally hoped that the IWW would be sort of like the trade union arm of the socialists, which makes sense. I understand what he was thinking. That didn't prove to sort of be the case. There was a schism really between socialists who wanted to continue to sort of advocate for electoral activism in addition to unionism, whereas most Wobblies were cynical or skeptical of elections and voting. Fletcher wasn't an anarchist, but there's no evidence that he voted, although there's also evidence that he wasn't critical of those who did. He didn't personally find that sort of to be a sort of a strategy that would be effective. But Eugene Debs was there, and he was the most famous socialist and sort of unionist in America. Just 10 years prior, he had led the largest strike in America in the 1890s when he led railroad workers in a massive strike that shut down the national economy briefly in the summer of 1894, right? And Big Bill Haywood, another sort of legendary figure in the IWW, who was the leader of the Western Federation of Miners, which was expressly socialist and often engaged in actual combat with employers, because dynamite was a common tool in the industry of digging deep mines in the Rocky Mountains and other parts of the West, right? He had one eye, which he had lost in an accident as a child, but was also, so you have these very dramatic figures, right? Those are some of the co-founders, right, of the IWW, which also was expressly anti-nationalist from its birth, right? Some people wanted to call it the Industrial Workers of America, and that was voted down in exchange for a name that they preferred, the Industrial Workers of the World. And there were non-Americans present at the founding too, people from Canada, someone originally born in Germany, right? Maybe some Spanish people who were present. And very quickly, within a few years, there were IWW branches in Canada, in Mexico, soon in Australia, New Zealand, in many countries across Europe, right? In Southern Africa, right? And many parts of the Caribbean and South America, right? And so there was no sort of global plan. But there was essentially individual Wobblies who sort of brought these ideas and literature with them. Many were sailors, right? And essentially exported the IWW ideas. There are also similar traditions in many countries that is sort of evolved independently of the IWW, right? And so for those of us who are familiar with, for instance, the CNT or other sort of anarchistic unions in Spain and sort of the Iberian Peninsula, those are similar traditions, right? Like they're overlapping, but they're not the same. And it's not like they were created by the IWW. But these are peoples who shared much in common. And there was an international network of syndicalists and anarchists who continued to operate after World War I as well, because they were courted by, but ultimately many remained separate from the Comintern and then the Profintern that the Soviets created in order to try to control, or lead, right, a sort of an international communist movement, right? Like, and so these are competing traditions that sort of are around, but the IWW was widely known as being essentially the largest conglomeration of radicals in the US, really into the 20s and into the 30s. The communists ultimately will grow larger, but not until the 1930s did the communists have much power in the US. Before that time, really, the Wobblies were probably the largest left union slash organization in the United States, despite massive repression during and after World War I. It's also worth noting that sort of work was dangerous, right? Like, and so this sort of work was one of the most dangerous occupations in the world, right? Before containerization is introduced in the 1960s and 70s, the sort of the loading and unloading of ships, you could die any day you walk on the job, right? Like, and injuries were quite common. It would be rare to find someone who hadn't had at least a few injuries, often severe. And this is in a time in the US where there was essentially zero compensation for people. And this is prior to, well, we still don't have national health insurance, right? Like, and so, you know, in the United States, so Fletcher, it was dangerous working, right? Like, but as you noted, for Fletcher, as an African-American, additional dangers existed. Philadelphia experienced racial violence in the 19-teens on multiple occasions, but nationwide there were, you know, it depended on the year, but 50 to 100 lynchings a year. So every week there could be 1 to 2 extra legal murders of African Americans. And there's zero examples of lynch mobs being brought to justice, right? And so for Fletcher, he's got a, you know, he's aware of that. Like, as any Black person, right, but especially as a radical, you noted he was a great speaker. He put himself out in public in a lot of ways. And at that time, speaking on streets and corners and at sort of street meetings was sort of the way that sort of gatherings occurred often. He traveled up and down the U.S. East Coast, the Atlantic Coast, to organize. He was frequently requested by other locals to sort of come, especially port cities. So Boston, Providence, Rhode Island, which is a smaller port, in sort of southern New England, but had a lot of Black workers because oddly, there was a bunch of people of Portuguese ancestry, including from the Azores, right? And so there's Black Portuguese speaking people who are dockers in Rhode Island, right, in New York City, in Baltimore, which is pretty close to Philadelphia, and also is the other big port in that region. And then as far south as Norfolk, Virginia, which Virginia being the sort of quote unquote South, right? And the further south you go on the Atlantic coast, the larger number of Black people are working class, or the working class is more Black, right? Because the South remained where most African Americans lived. And so famously in 1917, this is before the United States actually declared war, even though the war had already been going on for 3 years in Europe, right? He was organizing Norfolk dockers. At that time, most dockers in Norfolk were African-American. He was challenged while speaking at a meeting. According to a later interview he did, friends of his advised him that he should get out of the city or he might get murdered. And so he was basically snuck aboard a ship and ended up in Boston and ended up living in Boston for a few months, right? And was organizing up there before the federal government found him and started spying on him. In between, the United States had declared war, right? Like, and so suddenly the US government had passed new laws to sort of basically survey people that it did not believe were sort of good Americans or supportive of the war. Like many leftists, there was a lot of suspicion and opposition to the US declaration of war, as well as in Europe, even though ultimately in Europe, most socialists ultimately supported their national causes as opposed to sort of sticking to internationalism. And so, you know, for Fletcher, the dangers were many, right? Once the war began, those increased because he and many other Wobbly leaders ended up being arrested by the federal government and imprisoned after a mass trial in Chicago in 1918 in federal prison in the central part of the United States in a state called Kansas, where Fletcher and 100 other Wobblies were sort of thrown in. They were joined in that prison by other anti-war activists, including pacifists, some of whom were religious pacifists. They also, there was Mexican revolutionaries, because there's a Mexican revolution going on too in that era, right? Including a man named Ricardo Flores Magón, who was a famous anarchist revolutionary who lived in the US often, right? There were communists, also had been sort of thrown into Leavenworth, or Bolsheviks, as they were often called at that time, including Earl Browder, who later became the leader of the Communist Party in the United States, right? And so Leavenworth, this town in Kansas, where the first federal prison was this collection basically of hundreds of radicals, as well as common criminals, so-called. Fletcher was subject to sort of persecution because of his race. He was also subject to persecution because of his politics, right? Although the racism was probably more real on a day-to-day basis, ultimately it was governmental dislike of him that sent him to prison, right? Although after he got out of prison, after about 4 years with some time off, he went back to organizing, which is noteworthy because he could have been thrown back in prison very easily. His release and all the others was conditional on not breaking any more laws. But of course, union activists were arrested all the time for no reason whatsoever by local police, simply as a way to sort of serve the interests of local capital. And so Fletcher was bold, right? And his time in prison, while no doubt sort of impactful, didn't change his politics or his choice of professions. He remained an organizer, a union organizer in the IWW after getting out of prison as well, right? The sort of the list of ways that Fletcher sort of looked danger in the face and continued the struggle is impressive. It would be easy for him to have tried to basically reduce his sort of dangers, although he couldn't change his skin color, and he was a very dark-skinned Black man. And so no one was going to sort of think he was going to be passing, as some lighter-skinned Black people in the United States occasionally would try to do to avoid racism in their daily lives.
The Espionage Act and the Sedition Act were passed after the US entered World War I in 1917, and they were used against members of the IWW, including Ben Fletcher. And it resulted in the arrest and indictment of 166 Wobblies, and many subsequently were imprisoned, including Fletcher. Can you tell us about this?
Of course. So you know, once the United States declares war in April of 1917, shortly after the U.S. Congress passes what's called the Espionage Act, and later passes a second law called the Sedition Act that basically criminalized dissent, which is to say, if you are in opposition to the war, even if you just speak the words or write them down, this is before radio does not yet exist, right? For those of us who are a little challenged in terms of our mass communication technologies, right? So print, right? Could get you imprisoned, right? And in fact, thousands of Americans and immigrants were imprisoned by the US government for speaking out against the war, right? And World War I was not a particularly popular war in the United States because the United States wasn't attacked. Right. And so in the same reason, there was massive opposition to conscription in Australia, for example. Right. So, too, in the United States, there was a lot of skepticism about the war, even though after the declaration of war, most Americans, quote unquote, rallied around the flag. These laws, these espionage and sedition laws, were sort of cynically used against the IWW, which already was sort of disliked by the US federal government, which generally supported employers. I shouldn't say generally, I should say in almost every instance in which the government sort of takes a side, if you will, they take the side of employers, right? This is also before US law exists to recognize that workers have a right to unionize or go on strike. That would not exist until 1935. And so 18 years later, right? And so when these laws are passed, The IWW is the largest and perceived as the most dangerous left-wing organization in the United States, right? The Socialist Party actually had probably more members, right? Or at least voters, but like didn't have the power, arguably. The IWW happened to be well organized in a number of, quote, strategic industries, unquote. Transportation, right? Like, for instance, the Port of Philadelphia, which is a major port to sort of send troops and war material to our allies, as well as to, for US soldiers that were starting to be shipped to France and Belgium, right? Like the IWW had a lot of members in the timber industry in the West, wood still being an important building material, right? And also in the mining industry, including copper, right? Which was an essential material for many industrial products, including electrical, right? The IWW also organized in agriculture, the first major union to ever try to organize farm workers in the United States, right? And food, of course, is a natural resource of that's vital, right? And so the IWW actually had strong unions in a number of key industries that scared the bejesus, right, out of employers and also the state, right? And so as soon as basically these laws were passed, the federal government, before really the war begins, really for the US, the war against anti-war people begins, right? Like, and so the Wobblies were, hundreds of Wobblies were arrested, right? In 1917 and 1918, basically the entire leadership across the country at the national and many locals. In Philadelphia, Letcher was one of six Philadelphians who were arrested and put on trial in 1918 in a federal trial in Chicago, right? And so there is, that is happening, right? Ultimately, a lot of people debate this, a lot of people, historians debate, right? Like, you know, the IWW still exists, but for a lot of people, the IWW basically stops existing in this era, right? Because the government repression, and I should also note many state governments also sort of joined in, right? Destroyed the IWW in many places, right? Or radically weakened it. And that's undeniable. Their membership remains somewhat similar, but their really power and influence in the 1920s wanes. And then in the 1930s in the United States, other unions, especially affiliated with what was becomes known as the CIO, come to dominate. Many Wobblies were part of and shaped the CIO, but it wasn't revolutionary, even though it was open to women, Mexicans, African-Americans, and others. So they took some of the radicalism of the IWW, but was shorn of its anti-capitalism, although there were communists and others in the CIO unions. So like, you know, the IWW was drastically hurt, right, by the repression, which continued after the war ended in what became known as the first Red Scare in the United States. I'm mindful that this is not unique to the United States, right? Like, I'm also mindful that, you know, Irish revolutionaries are sort of fighting for freedom in this era too. And we haven't talked about it, right? But Jim Larkin and James Connolly, both were Wobblies. Connolly lived in the US before coming back to Ireland, right? And had joined the IWW very early, like 1907, I believe, right? And Larkin later traveled to the US after the sort of 1913 lockout and spoke at Joe Hill's funeral in Chicago, I believe, in 1915. And, you know, also noteworthy that he was, you know, came out of a Dockers union, right? Like, just like Fletcher, although I have no knowledge that they ever met. You know, and then there was also Irish Americans, right? There, you had mentioned Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was a born and raised in New York City. Father was a socialist, and she, as a teenager, she became a socialist and then a Wobbly, right? In Philadelphia, John Walsh or Jack Walsh was New York City born Irish American, but who before World War I was in Philly and was also one of the leaders, also one of the people who was arrested and imprisoned in Leavenworth, and also got out and remained a fiery organizer, although he disappears from the public record, unfortunately. And the name John Walsh is not one of the easier names to follow because it's too common, right? you know, so the during World War I and after World War I is sort of a fascinating time. The repression does weaken the Union in Philadelphia, which holds on actually for another 4 years. But the leadership, the removal of the top level of leaders did weaken the Union. And what happens in Philadelphia, Fletcher's Union Local 8, sort of somewhat tracks what's happening around the country in the United States, which is that there's this big wave during and after the war of labor activism. And then employer, you might say, counter-offensive, which succeeds. And it won't be until then the early 1930s, about 12 or 14 years later, that then we see in the US a sort of a surge of unionism again, right? Like, and so the exact timeline is a little different, but the general trends were clear, right? The Wobblies are really powerful in the teens and then are weakened, right? And then in the 30s, more unionism emerges in the US and some other countries, but under different leaders and really different organizations, right? Fletcher will also remain an IWW organizer into the 1930s. He remains committed to the IWW, even though there's far fewer members. And for leftists, the action is in the Communist Party and the CIO. And that's where most Americans who are anti-capitalist find themselves by the 1930s.
He formed a close friendship with Big Bill Haywood. Would Haywood have been a major political influence on him? And were there any other significant influences on friendships that Ben Fletcher had?
So for Ben Fletcher, you know, as Ben Fletcher was the most important African-American in the IWW across the United States. And really, although the IWW organized in many other countries, to my knowledge, there was no other person of African descent who was as influential. So Fletcher was a very well-known figure in his world in the 19-teens and actually into the 20s and 30s, right? He's been quote unquote forgotten, but he was well-known in his time on the left. He was deeply respected by people like A. Philip Randolph, who later becomes sort of a leader of a Black Railroad Workers Union and then a leader in the civil rights movement, right? Like he and the IWW were known by W.E.B. Du Bois, who was an important Black intellectual, but also a leader in the NAACP who later becomes a communist, right? So Fletcher would have known of everybody because his eyes were open and he was in the movement, right? Like who he knew, there's, documentation is sort of occasionally scarce. He definitely, Big Bill Haywood referred to him as a friend, and I have no reason to believe otherwise, right? Like, during the trials, right, Fletcher made a number of jokes that were then essentially recorded in the press, but also by Haywood in his subsequent autobiography. The most well-known was like that, you know, on the day that the trial was ending, when the jury came back guilty, and then the judge was reading out the sentences, and Fletcher famously said to Haywood, turned to Fletcher and said, "The judge doesn't speak with very good grammar." And Haywood says, "How's that, Ben?" And he says, "That's because his sentences are much too long," right? Because Fletcher was sentenced to 10 years in prison. Many Wobblies were sentenced to 5 to 20 years in prison. Haywood got 20. Haywood actually jumped bail, right, when he was released on bond after being imprisoned, and ended up fleeing to the Soviet Union, where he lived his last 10 years of life. Some Wobblies were very resentful that Haywood did that because those who had put up the money in bond lost that, but also that he ended up becoming a communist. Many Wobblies ended up becoming communists for any number of reasons. Most obvious being that this is where the action is, and the Soviets had proven to be sort of that you could actually succeed in a socialist revolution, right? Like many Wobblies did not join the communist movement, right? Fletcher being among them, and Fletcher actually was sort of bitter towards communists, believing that the communists wanted to essentially take the IWW and sort of reaffiliate it in mass. Logically so, given the IWW had so many supporters, right? When the Wobblies chose to not affiliate, the IWW sort of was often seen as persecuted by the communists. And there's a long sort of deep sort of weedy sort of conversation about how this plays out in Philadelphia after World War I. Fletcher probably knew Jack Reed, right? Who later reported from the Soviet Union at the birth and wrote 10 Days That Shook the World, one of the most important books about the Russian Revolution written in English, and was widely circulated in the States, right? Some people believe, and I'm inclined to believe, he knew Joe Hill. Anyone would have passed through Philly because it's one of the biggest cities in the country and it's only a few hours from New York City. And so over the course of his activism in the teens and 20s, he probably would have met anyone who passed through Philadelphia, right? Like we don't always have that documented, right? But it's just reasonable to conclude, right? Like given his importance, right? And so he was well known, as I say, in his circles, right? Not sort of a household name, but among those who were sort of activists on the left and unionists, and also among African-Americans, right? Who were radicals, right? Those are sort of overlapping yet somewhat separate circles, right? Like that Fletcher was very, very well known now, or really since his time, not well known. I've tried very hard over the last few decades to sort of change that in a little way. But he moved to New York in the 30s, had a major stroke in the mid-1930s when he was in his 40s, and lived another 15 years. But his second wife was probably the primary breadwinner, but they probably also were pretty poor. He was buried in 1949 in an unmarked grave. Generally, that suggests that they didn't have the money for a proper burial, although it's sometimes people chose not to be in marked graves, like Quakers sometimes like did that. We don't know why, but it's the logical conclusion is that he and his wife didn't have the money for a sort of a more expensive burial, right? Like, although there's a group of us who are now working to change that, and he will, within the next year, I'm confident, have a small marker in the cemetery where he's buried in Brooklyn in order to honor his memory, right? But in the US, I say often, last year there was a film that came out called Judas and the Black Messiah. It was about the Black Panther, Fred Hampton, who was murdered by the city of Chicago in 1969. Hampton was a young Black socialist revolutionary who was murdered by the state, right? Who also organized across racial lines. And although the Panthers are sometimes seen as being anti-white, that's incorrect. They were anti-capitalist and they often worked with white, Latino, and other revolutionaries, right? Maybe in separate organizations, but in alliance. The first Rainbow Coalition in Chicago was led by the Panthers, right? So Fletcher is a lot like Hampton, right? Like Black men who in their teens became revolutionaries and socialists. When I say revolutionary, I mean socialist, actually, but also anti-racist. And also because of their Blackness, can't ignore race in the ways that sometimes white revolutionaries do. And then suffered persecution, state persecution, because of their radicalism. Hampton, fortunately, is better known, especially in Chicago, but this film, this feature film, actually elevated his profile in a significant way. It's not a documentary, it's not entirely accurate, but it's a wonderful film that shows the milieu. Fletcher, well, he hasn't had a movie made about him, right? And isn't no well-known, period, right? Like, I'm also working with a group of people in Philadelphia, actually, the city has approved an application to have a mural painted for Fletcher and the Union Local 8. We're still identifying the proper building and artist, but the city will be paying for that mural. Hopefully it'll open or be unveiled May 8, 2023. Although that's to be determined, right? Like, and we're also getting a historical sign we're applying for to be located at the old Union Hall's address. Although due to gentrification, the building that was there was torn down and a new, very fancy private home was built up. But we hope to have a sign up, a sort of a state historical marker at the location where the Union Hall was located. The IWW was revolutionary, so they didn't own property, right? And so they rented their space, right? And anyway, that was 100 years ago. There are actually a growing number of people who want to sort of remember his legacy as a sort of a revolutionary Black socialist unionist. That's not a common biography in the United States. As the Amazon labor union happens, as there's growing activism in various different ways in the United States in the 2020s. Fletcher is, I think, of much more interest now than he's been. I mean, when I started working on this union as a doctoral student, no one knew about him and no one cared. Now there's a few more people who care, right? Like, I think it's because of the times that we live in, right? That there's more people willing to consider more radical alternatives because the status quo is unacceptable. But also, I think because there's more people of color who are assertive and more non-Black people who are open to racial inclusion and racial equality. And so therefore are more interested in the story of a person like Ben Fletcher.
The comparison to Hampton is quite apt, I think. The Black Panther Party were also revolutionary for their time, like even by today's standards, with their Breakfast for School Children program, etc. Can we talk a little bit about what he did after his release?
The trail, to study non-elite people in sort of the past is always challenging, right? Like, and in the case of Fletcher, we I've spent years in, after the book I originally published about Ben Fletcher was published about 15 years ago. And then I was lucky enough that a different publisher, PM Press, wanted to reissue it. But the second edition is actually twice as long as the first edition, because over the interim dozen years, I had learned much more about Fletcher, but also people had shared with me what they had known. So for example, I know much more about his life after the 20s, but not very much, right? Like, sadly, he shows up in the early 30s in New York City. There's a few documented cases of him speaking at various different events, right? Interestingly, one was for coal miners in Eastern Kentucky in the mid-1930s, which was a big labor sort of chapter, I guess. The song, "Which Side Are You On?" actually emerged from that struggle in Harlan County in Eastern Kentucky, right? Like, so there's documentation of him speaking at a sort of a basically an event, a solidarity event in New York City, right, in 1936. It's very interesting. It shows that he was still well known, right, but also that he was organizing. It wasn't a wobbly event, right? It was sort of like a sort of a coalition, I guess, right? Like, and I can't help but wonder if he might have sort of become active in the CIO if he had been able, although I don't really know that. There's just a little correspondence that we still have from the 40s with him and others. I have concluded, and he talks about in some of these correspondence, that he has had various different health ailments. Working class people, blue collar work is hard. Doc work is hard. This stroke is tough. In the United States, African Americans have lower life expectancy, poor health outcomes for any number of reasons due to sort of institutional racism, I'd say. They don't have a lot of money, right? Like, and so it's hard to know for sure, but his wife is, I believe, a nurse, his second wife. And so it seems that she was the primary, like I said, breadwinner. I know a man who's now in his 80s who knew Ben Fletcher as a child, because this man's father was good friends with Ben Fletcher in the 40s, in the 30s and 40s. And so that's over the last 10 years or so, getting to know this man in New York City, Anatole Dolgoff, whose father was named Sam Dolgoff, and who was a well-known, respected, wobbly and anarchist, self-taught author and intellectual. But Anatole knew Fletcher when he was just 7 or 8 years old, and he has, you know, memories of seeing him after World War II at the old, it's amazing that the IWW still had a sailor's hall. The IWW maintained halls, sailors. You come off a ship, you go to your union's hall, right? Like in lower Manhattan. Now this is a very expensive area, but at that time, Manhattan was still a working port. And so he has memories of hanging out with he and his brother being taken by their dad, right? To sort of going on a Sunday and hanging out with basically fellow like-minded people who were often, in the case of Fletcher, he wasn't old. He was only in his 50s. I'm in my 50s, right? Like, but who were weak, right? So we know that Fletcher maintained his politics, But we also know that he wasn't influencing many people outside of his immediate circle, right? Because he wasn't physically able to sort of continue the work, right? Like, that is unfortunate. I've sometimes, like I said, mused about what ifs, right? Like, if he doesn't have a stroke in the 34, does that, what does he do? He was only in his 40s, right? Like, it's easy to imagine that he would have been heavily involved. I guess just going back to what you said earlier, you know, yeah, he was very young when he became a radical. That is generally what we think of as normal, right? Like, when do people become radicalized? It's often in, you know, as one's a young adult and sort of exploring their ideas. Fletcher didn't graduate from high school, which was not uncommon. But based on his writings, he's clearly intelligent and educated, right? And that was common among working class people, especially on the docks and on ships. In that industry, you often have a lot of downtime and people would read a lot, right? Now, sadly, we have our phones and maybe we read on them, but like, it's not quite the same, right? Like, one of the young activists in Buffalo, New York, who's one of the leaders of the Starbucks workers campaign that sort of energized the United States over the last few months. You know, she was radicalized as a teen. I read a long sort of interview with article about her, and, you know, Eugene Debs, right, the former Wobblian socialist, like, reading about his opposition to World War I. If there is a lower class, I am in it, right? If there is a criminal class, I am of it. Right. Like the speech he gives when he is sentenced to prison for the same crime that Fletcher was sentenced to prison was radicalized this young woman from, I forget, Tennessee. Right. In the 20 teens. Right. And fast forward a few years and now she's a union activist and well-known leader. Right. Who was inspired. Right. Like, I don't know if Fletcher had an aha moment. There's no documentation of that. But, you know, being a young Black man in America is a radicalizing experience because who knows? All it might take is someone treating him badly. Maybe it's a cop who's harassing him and he starts questioning things, right? Like, I say that just sort of, he would have, you know, through his lived experience, it wouldn't have been hard. The impressive part is that he chose to take actions. A lot of people might be angry and want change, but appreciate that that's a risky proposition or that they don't have the time or energy or figure out what to do. By contrast, Fletcher found the IWW, which opened up to him sort of the tools, the sort of the language literally, but also the tactics that he clearly embraced, right? Because then, you know, from the early 19 teens, he then became the most important Black Wobbly, as I call him, in the history of this union. Yeah.
How did you first come across Ben Fletcher?
Well, like, you know, I was in my early 20s. I started graduate school in the early 1990s. And I was interested in the history of the labor movement, because I believed that unions were the single greatest way for poor people to be less poor, right? I mean, what unions do is essentially pull wealth downward because collectively workers can command higher wages if they're union. And so, living in New York City for college in the late 80s, the late Reagan, early first Bush era, homelessness was pervasive. And so to me, I was like, how, you know, poverty and inequality are very real. How do we change that? Well, unions actually are one way. So I consider unions to be the, what Martin Luther King called them, the greatest anti-poverty program, right? Like, so I had those sorts of thoughts. I was also, as a young white American in the late 80s, thinking about, thanks to teachers and professors, race in the United States. And so I was interested in sort of this issues I'm still interested in, you know, how to organize for sort of social justice, although that's sort of vague, right? Really for radical change in a multiracial society, right? So looking for unions that were anti-racist, although that term, we didn't use that term in the US, at least in the 90s. But there were very few unions before the 1930s that had done such work. And in a class, I basically came across the IWW. Like most Americans, I had never heard of the IWW, even though I was a history undergraduate student, and then was in graduate school at the time. And then in this large book about the IWW, there was like a few lines and a few paragraphs about Ben Fletcher and his part. And I'm like, who is this guy? The one Black member of the IWW leadership imprisoned in Leavenworth during and after World War I. And that began, in a way, my journey, because I was interested in trying to find a multiracial union that was sort of consciously and overtly working against racism. And that's really rare in the history of the United States before the 30s, even though some unions in the 1930s and beyond become sort of much more open to people of color. Many weren't, right? And even in the late 20th century, and one might say the early 21st century, there's still racism in the labor movement. I actually think most unions are generally better than most institutions in the US, but there's a lot of room for improvement. But going back a century, that was not the case. Most unions were all white, or treated Blacks, if they let them in sort of dramatically worse ways, second class, right? And so I was interested in Fletcher and the Union Local 8 because they did what I thought was sort of important work to be done. And no one had ever worked on it before, right? And for graduate students in this little world of academia, you actually have to, as a graduate student, create original work. Right now I could write on whatever I want, but as a grad student, you have to actually find something new. And this was new, like, which is to say that no one had actually ever written anything substantial about them. And so it's funny because, like, I actually continue to believe this is fascinating and important. In the 90s and the early 2000s, far fewer people did, right? Like the idea that someone in Ireland would contact me to want to talk about this work is, of course, very honored, right? No one was doing this 20 years ago, right? Like the world is changing in ways that I think are for the better, right? There's a lot more interest in this sort of radical future. And so some of us therefore look to the past for inspiration, for education, for sort of lessons to be learned, what sometimes is referred to as a usable past. And that of course makes me very happy, right? I ultimately chose to investigate this once I learned about it because no one else had, right? Like it seemed that there was something to be done, right? Like, I guess I think there's still more work to be done, right? Like, but that was how I personally became interested in this subject. It was sort of dumb luck in a way, reading a book, heaven forbid, right? Like, and learned that there was this person existed, but also learned after a few weeks of investigating that really very little was known about him. And so one of the things I've done in recent decades is try to find it. The last thing I'll say about that is, although Fletcher didn't keep any personal records, the federal government cared a lot about Ben Fletcher, right? And the IWW. And so a large number of my sources come from the federal government, which saw Fletcher and the IWW as enemies, but therefore kept a lot of records. They spied on them, right? Like, and so it's ironic. This is also the case for example, of the FBI when it spies on the Black Panthers, right, in the 1960s and 70s, or Martin Luther King, right? Like, is that once these records become public, and it varies, right, but in the IWW's case, this was over 100 years ago, then we can basically find out what they were doing by way of those who are surveying them, right? Like, and that is, like I said, ironic because, like, if they hadn't been surveyed, who knows what they would have achieved, but we might not have known what they did in as detail were it not for these sorts of records, right? Which are not sort of entirely perfect either. And the government actually confiscated tons of wobbly records during the war and then used them in these trials. But then, well, we don't know what happened, but it's widely believed, and I believe, that those records were destroyed in the 1920s. There was no laws that prevented them from destroying records. And that's not uncommon in many cultures, right? Just get rid of this, you know? And so it's unfortunate, but like, The IWW also, therefore, lost a lot of its records up through 1917 because the federal government took them, right? Like, so it's a challenge to study radicals generally and revolutionaries. They also don't always write things down for in purpose. And in the case of Fletcher, he had no children, right? Trying to piece these stories. The biography that I sort of created, as you know, that was also PM Press as a British, right, distribution too. You know, it's an unusual biography because there's a lengthy introduction that's basically a short book, right? And then the majority of the book is actually documents everything I pretty much found out about him, by him or about him, and then with brief introductions written by me. And it allows people to sort of be their own historian. But in a way, what I'm describing is also historians are often compared to sort of detectives because we have to sort of go down all these paths in order to investigate. For many of us, that's sort of exciting and interesting in a way, right? Like it takes time and effort. But so a reader of this book could basically just read these documents and sort of draw their own conclusions, right? Which is what we do as historians when we, but I also provide some guidance, right? Because sometimes the context is unclear for a reader without a sort of a few sentences or a paragraph explanation, right? And so I enjoyed writing this book but it's a very unusual sort of biography because it includes a lot of the, what a historian would call primary source or original documents from the era. But I also think that makes it actually very interesting. Many readers enjoy having that opportunity to see these things for themselves instead of having a sort of a third party mediate, right, between the time and sort of now. Yeah, so that's a little on me.
I was surprised when you said that you had only learned about the IWW in university. I'd have thought, possibly naively, that this would be taught in school. To finish up, can we talk about his relevance today and why it's important more people become aware of him and his contribution?
So a member of the IWW who was a legendary folk singer in the second half of the 20th century named Utah Phillips, who probably is not very well known, passed away about 10 years ago. He said, you know, we don't learn our history. We learn the history of the ruling class, right? Like, and so not surprisingly in public schools in the United States, we don't learn the history of radical unionists. We learn histories that basically sort of justify the present. By contrast, in Ireland, you have the quote unquote problem that you can't escape that the Republican leadership was, and many of the followers were socialists, right? Like, and so the American Revolution was not led from working class socialists. It was led, of course, earlier by sort of enslavers and sort of elites, right? Who had some good reasons to want to break away from the English, but who weren't the sort of the rabble, but were in fact sort of the those with power, right? Like, and so, you know, the American Revolution is somewhat conservative, right? Like, and Tom Paine, the great English immigrant to the United States, very much understood as a founding father, the author of Common Sense, the most important document of that era. But he's often sort of a second tier figure, even compared to Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Hamilton, et cetera, all of whom were rich, right? You know, in the United States, I think about this because of what you said. Like, I teach introduction to US history at the university level. I talk in my survey, my introduction to the US in the early 20th century about the IWW, but only briefly, right? There's a lot of subjects to talk about. And it's somewhat understandable that like people don't know about Fletcher and the IWW. It's horrible. I'm not entirely shocked, right? But you know, I do talk a lot about the history of working class people and unions in my surveys. But the IWW, even though it was fascinating and sort of, I believe, important, their numbers were smaller than a lot of other unions. The mainstream unions were larger even in their heyday. And they didn't achieve their goals, right? Like they were, whether they should have or shouldn't have. And so, I mean, it's not entirely surprising, but ultimately it's because most of us don't learn our history, and most people are not taught sort of history from below or revolutionary history. They're taught histories that justify the current system as it exists in whatever country one lives in, right? Like, people who sort of start to see the light, if you will, in their teens, maybe, or 20s, or if, depending on their parents, right? Like, but I came from a very sort of ordinary, apolitical, middle-class family without a union background. I knew nothing, but I know that I'm normal in the US in terms of my ignorance, right? Like, I was fortunate to sort of learn and then sort of follow down this path and become a historian, but like most of us aren't. Right. And so that is sad. Right. Like podcasts and the web. And now there's actually a lot of other ways to access knowledge, historical and other. And that's beautiful. Right. I assume that if Ben Fletcher was alive, he'd be sort of online, too. Right. And that's great. Right. Like, I mean, we can sort of correct the failings of the past, which is to say we could learn more about the past. That's what we're both trying to do, right? Like, you know, is to try to sort of correct these failings. But yeah, my experience I know is the norm. I do try to teach differently than the way I was taught. Although most people don't go to university, right? Like, and so it's really about getting the sort of history into what we would call high school, right, would be the appropriate place. But it depends on the teacher. Some teachers do this, most don't. Yeah.
That's it for another episode of the Irish People podcast. Thank you to our guest, Dr. Peter Cole. We highly recommend his book, Ben Fletcher, The Life and Times of a Black Wobbly. We'll be back again soon with another episode. So until then, Slán go fóill.